I'm going to give part five of our Comforter sermon series. But before we do that, we have some special music. And I heard this song on the radio a couple of months ago, and I've been saving it up for now because I think it fits in. It's the title is That'll Do, and it's composed. It was composed by Randy Newman. It's quite famous. And it was actually composed for a children's movie that you might have heard of, with the unlikely title of Babe, Pig in the City. I don't know if they've seen it. But it's performed by Peter Gabriel, who used to be in the group called Genesis. And I chose the song because of its very encouraging lyrics, and certainly not because the title indicates, you know, certainly did not want to suggest that mediocrity or half-hearted effort is acceptable to God, not at all. On the contrary, if we're and what I want to get across in the sermon today as well is, if we're doing our best, if we're all doing our best, if we're giving it everything we've got with our own God-given talents, and plus, obviously, with the great power of God's Holy Spirit within us, that's all we can do. And I believe that our father and our elder brother are very happy with that. That they're very happy with That'll Do.
Before you know it, you'll hear someone say, that'll do.
How many have read the book Robinson Crusoe?
I haven't.
You know, you've read that?
It's a great story, isn't it?
Yeah. And of course, if you haven't read it, you know, I'm sure you know the story. And like Zane, and like many, I read it years ago when I was a schoolboy, first of all. And, you know, it's all exciting and everything else. But I reread it more recently. I was trying to go through all of the famous classic novels, you know. And it was actually some time ago now. And I was amazed to find that it was so very inspiring in a religious way, in a spiritual way. And it is, it's a work of pure fiction, there's no doubt about that. But it was written by a man by the name of Daniel Defoe. And if he were alive today, I'd email him and I'd tell him that his famous book helped me through some of the greatest trial periods of my life back in the 1990s. So how could a fictional book be so inspiring? And again, if you're not familiar with the story, we've got poor old Robinson Crusoe. He's in one of the most dreadful predicaments imaginable. He's been shipwrecked on a desert island. He's the sole survivor of the wreck and literally doesn't know where on earth he is. He endures years and years of the most terrible dangers and trials, loneliness, tropical heat, storms, disease, and fevers. And if that weren't enough, to add to all of those problems, wild animals and cannibals want to have him over for lunch. During the course of the story, Robinson is writing in the first person singular in like a diary format. It's very, you know, it's very easy to read. It's like somebody writing in a diary. And he tells how right there on this desert island that he's called by God. He's called by God, not audibly or visibly or verbally, but spiritually. And he tells how he goes through a very deep and meaningful repentance process. So he salvaged a couple of Bibles from the wrecked ship, and he begins to study the Bible in earnest. He studies it every day, and he talks to God almost constantly as he goes through the book there. He learns to depend on God for his spiritual deliverance as well as for his physical deliverance from all the tremendous dangers and problems and trials that now beset him. So throughout the narrative, he quotes the Bible over and over again, and not in a sugary or over emotional way, but surprisingly very accurately and meaningfully. I'd recommend that you get it out the library and read it again, because it is very worthwhile. The two of the scriptures that he quotes which affected me and inspired me most were these two. Please turn to Psalm 50. Psalm 50. And verse 15, just one verse here, Psalm chapter 50, verse 15. And call upon me in the day of trouble, I will deliver you, and you shall glorify me. And then all the way over in the New Testament to Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews chapter 13. And verse 5, let your conversation, in the New King James Version, actually conduct, let your conduct be without covetousness, and be content with such things as you have. For he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. I will never leave you nor forsake you. Let me ask a question. Are you and I, are we like the fictional Robinson Crusoe, at least in some ways? Have we learned to trust in God for our deliverance from the dangers and the trials, both spiritual trials and physical trials? Or do we somehow think sometimes that God's miraculous protection somehow ceased after the death of the last New Testament personality, the Apostle John? In the sermon today, what I want to do, and again this is part 5 and the last part of this Comforter series, what I'd like to do is to show you and myself as well that God today is just as capable of miraculously protecting his children as he always was. First of all, let's go back in time. Let's go back to what we call Bible times. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 12, please. Genesis chapter 12. Is thousands of years ago, God made some great promises to his obedient servant, Abram, as his name was at this time, Abraham later on. Promises of wealth and blessings and greatness, but also of protection. Protection. Genesis chapter 12 and verses 1 to 3. Now the Lord had said unto Abram, get you out of your country and from your kindred and from your father's house unto a land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless you, and curse him that curses you. And in you shall all the families of the earth be blessed. I'll go over a couple of chapters to chapter 14. Chapter 14 and verses 18 to 20. Genesis chapter 14 and verse 18. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine. And he was the priest of the Most High God. And he, Melchizedek, blessed him, blessed Abram, and said, blessed be Abram of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be the Most High God, which has delivered your enemies into your hand. Won't go into all of the detail of that, those deliverances, but it was God who did it. It was God who delivered his enemies into his hand. And then over to Genesis chapter 22, please. 22. Genesis chapter 22 and verse 17. That in blessing I will bless you, and in multiplying I will multiply your seed as the stars of the heaven, and as the sand which is upon the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gate of his enemies. We're going to come to that again in a couple of minutes. And in your seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. And that's an important part as well. So as we read on now in the book of Genesis and Numbers and Deuteronomy, we see the history of these blessings being passed down through Abraham and Abraham's descendants, down to Isaac, down to Jacob, down to Joseph, down to Ephraim, down to Manasseh, and down to the children of Israel. And during the Feast of Unleavened Bread every year, we read about the great miraculous, or the great miracles, if you will, that the Lord God performed at the Red Sea in order to rescue his people from the Egyptians. So let's take another quick look at this account in the context today of God's physical protection and rescue. So let's go over to Exodus chapter 14. Exodus chapter 14. We're going to read verse 9 all the way down to verse 22. Exodus chapter 14. But the Egyptians pursued after them, the children of Israel, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them encamping by the sea beside Pi-hahiroth and before Baal-zephon. And when Pharaoh drew nigh, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. And they were sore afraid, and the children of Israel cried out unto the Lord. Jump down to verse 13, please. Verse 13. And Moses said unto the people, Fear not, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will show to you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you shall see them again no more forever. The Lord shall fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. And the Lord said unto Moses, Why cry you unto me? Speak unto the children of Israel, that they go forward. But lift you up your rod, and stretch out your hand over the sea, and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And I, behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. And I will get me honor upon Pharaoh, and upon all his host, upon his chariots, and upon his horsemen. And the Egyptians, who were left alive back home, anyway, shall know that I am the Lord, when I have gotten me honor upon Pharaoh, upon his chariots, and upon his horsemen. And the angel of God, which went before the camp of Israel, removed and went behind them. And the pillar of the cloud went from before their face and stood behind them. And it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel, and it was a cloud and darkness to them, to the Egyptians, but it gave light by night to these, to the Israelites, so that the one came not near the other all the night. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. And the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea, and upon the dry ground, and the waters were a wall unto them on their right hand and on their left. And we all know what happened and what God did to the Egyptian armies, as he had promised. Fantastic miracles, unbelievable, I shouldn't say unbelievable, but just astonishing miracles, to be sure. But then we ask the question, can God, does God still perform such miracles of physical protection in modern times? Let's fast forward to the year 1940. Now, after a long deferral due to the great sins of Israel, God began to fulfill his promises to the patriarchs more fully and to shower blessings on their descendants. And the peak of these blessings, from what we understand, apparently began around the start of the 18th century. It would appear, though, that in the late spring of 1940, God had not yet finished with his blessings of miraculous protection in favor of the descendants of ancient Israel. Right now, in the movie theaters, there's a movie called Dunkirk, and a Christopher Nolan movie. I haven't seen it. I would like to see it. And that movie has rekindled a lot of interest, recent interest in the evacuation of the Allied forces from Dunkirk. And that evacuation in 1940 is looked upon even by secular historians as a miracle, as a huge miracle. And its account contains some striking parallels to God's evacuation of the Israelites through the Red Sea. I want to quote extensively now from a book, an excellent book, written in 1960 by a magazine writer by the name of William Shirer. And the book is called The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. And specifically, I want to quote from a subchapter there entitled The Miracle at Dunkirk. So please listen to what happened here, and I'll hearken back to the Exodus as well. Ever since May the 20th, this is 1940 now, ever since May the 20th, when German General Guderian's tanks broke through to Abbeville on the sea, this is in northern France, the British Admiralty, on the personal orders of Winston Churchill, had been rounding up shipping for a possible evacuation of the BEF, that's the British Expeditionary Force, who'd gone over there to help out the French and the Belgians, and other Allied forces from the Channel ports. Non-combatant personnel began to be ferried across the narrow sea to England at once. By May the 24th, the German armour, striking up the coast from Abbeville, after taking Boulogne and enveloping Calais, had reached the Ar Canal, only 20 miles from Dunkirk. 20 miles from Dunkirk. That's, you know, that's not even from here to Nanaimo, so you can see how close they were. In between were caught the Belgian army, the 9 divisions of the BEF, the British Expeditionary Force, and 10 divisions of the French First Army. Though the terrain on the southern end of the pocket was bad tank country, being crisscrossed with canals, ditches, and flooded areas, Guderian's and Reinhardt's Panzer Corps already had 5 bridgeheads across the main barrier, the Ar Canal, between Gravelines on the sea and Saint-Omer, and were poised for the knockout blow which would hammer the Allied armies against the anvil of the advancing German 6th and 18th armies pushing down from the northeast, and would utterly destroy them. Suddenly, on the evening of May the 24th, came the peremptory order from the High Command, the German High Command, issued at the insistence of Hitler from the prompting of Field Marshal Rundstedt and Reich Marshal Göring, but over the violent objections of Field Marshal Brauchitz and General Halder, that the tank forces should halt on the canal line and attempt no further advance. This furnished Lord Gort, who was the commander of the Allied forces, okay, the British and French and the Belgian forces, this furnished Lord Gort an unexpected and vital reprieve, which he and the British Navy and Air Force made the most of, and which, as Rundstedt later perceived and said, led to one of the great turning points in the war. How did this inexplicable stop order on the threshold of what seemed certain to be the greatest German victory of the campaign come about? What were the reasons for it, and who was responsible? These questions have provoked one of the greatest arguments of the war among the German generals involved and among the historians. Göring had intervened with Hitler. He offered to liquidate the entrapped enemy troops with his air force, the Luftwaffe, with his air force alone. The reasons for his ambitious and vain proposal were given the writer, William Shirer, in a letter from German ex-general Halder. Finally, on the evening of May the 26th, Hitler rescinded the stop order and the armoured forces could resume their advance on Dunkirk. By then, it was late. The cornered army had had time to strengthen his defences, and behind them was beginning to slip away to sea. No more now than in all the years before did he, Hitler, comprehend the character of the British nation. Nor did he and his generals, ignorant of the sea as they were and remained, dream that the sea-minded British could evacuate a third of a million men from a small battered port and from the exposed beaches right under their noses. At 3 minutes before seven on the evening of May the 26th, shortly after Hitler's stop order had been cancelled, the British Admiralty signalled the beginning of Operation Dynamo, as the Dunkirk evacuation was called. That night, the German army resumed its attack on the port from the west and the south, but now the panzers found it hard going and the tanks made little progress. And that's so reminiscent of Exodus chapter 14 there, in which the Lord looked unto the host of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and the cloud, and troubled the host of the Egyptians, and took off their chariot wheels, and they drove them heavily. It's just like he did the same to the German tanks there. Continuing then in the rise and fall of the Third Reich, Lord Gort had had time to deploy against them three infantry divisions with heavy artillery support. In the meantime, the evacuation began. An armada of 850 vessels of all sizes, shapes and methods of propulsion, from cruisers and destroyers to small sailboats and Dutch scoots, many of them manned by civilian volunteers from the English coastal towns, converged on Dunkirk. The first day, now listen to these numbers, the first day, May the 27th, they took off 7,669 troops. The next day, 17,804. The following day, 47,310. And on May the 30th, 53,823, for a total of 126,606 during the first 4 days. And this was far more than the Admiralty had hoped to get out. When the operation began, it counted on evacuating only about 45,000 men in the 2 days' time it then thought it would have. It was not until the fourth day of Operation Dynamo, on May the 30th, that the German High Command finally woke up to what was happening. For 4 days, the communiques of the OKW, that's the German High Command, had been reiterating that the encircled enemy armies were doomed. Let's go back to Exodus 14 again. You don't have to turn there. Pharaoh was to say of the children of Israel, they are entangled in the land. The wilderness has shut them in. And the a German High Command communique of May the 29th stated flatly, the British army, which has been compressed into the territory around Dunkirk, is also going to its destruction before our concentric attack. But it wasn't. It was going to sea, with the certainty that the men would live to fight another day. The next day, May the 31st, was the biggest day of all. Some 68,000 men were embarked for England, a third of them from the beaches, the rest of them from the Dunkirk harbour. A total of 194,620 men had now been taken out, more than four times the number originally hoped for. Where was the famed Luftwaffe, the German Air Force? Part of the time it was grounded by bad weather. And the rest of the time it encountered unexpected opposition from the Royal Air Force, which from bases just across the channel successfully challenged it for the very first time. Though outnumbered, the new British Spitfires proved more than a match for the Messerschmitts. The Luftwaffe failed to achieve what Goering had promised Hitler, the annihilation of the BEF. On June the 1st, the second highest day's total was evacuated, 64,429 men. By dawn of the next day, only 4,000 British troops remained in the perimeter, protected by 100,000 French who now manned the defences. The Luftwaffe at that time did not operate after dark, and during the nights of June the 2nd and the 3rd, the remainder of the BEF and 60,000 French troops were successfully brought out. Dunkirk, still defended stubbornly by 40,000 French soldiers, held out until the morning of June the 4th. By that day, 338,226 British and French soldiers had escaped the German clutches. And he finishes off that part. He says, a deliverance Dunkirk was to the British. So, you know, the author, William Shirer, after weighing the evidence, he felt that the stop order originated with Hitler himself, influenced by Hermann Göring, who in his vanity wanted his Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, of which he was the head, to have the glory of the victory rather than giving it to the German army. So just like Israel's exodus from Egypt, the course of history was again mightily changed through vanity. But again, who stopped the Guderian's tanks? Did God harden Hitler's heart as he did with Pharaoh's? Certainly looks that way. So we look at that, as amazing. And some might say, okay, now that Dunkirk episode is fantastic, but that was almost 80 years ago now. I wasn't even born then. After World War II, we could ask the question, did God cut our nations off from his protection because of our national sins? When I first came into the church, I believe that he probably had, because of the sins of modern Israel. Or has he protected or delivered the descendants of Israel in more recent years? Please turn to Deuteronomy chapter 7. Deuteronomy chapter 7. Deuteronomy chapter 7, I want to read from verse 17 to 24. Deuteronomy 7, verse 17. If you shall say in your heart, these nations are more than I, how can I dispossess them? Remember that word, dispossess. You shall not be afraid of them, God says, but shall well remember what the Lord your God did unto Pharaoh and unto all Egypt. The great temptations which your eyes saw, and the signs and the wonders, and the mighty hand and the stretched out arm, whereby the Lord your God brought you out, so shall the Lord your God do unto all the people of whom you are afraid. Moreover, the Lord your God will send the hornet among them until they are left, until they that are left and hide themselves from you be destroyed. You shall not be affrighted at them, for the Lord your God is among you, a mighty God and terrible. And the Lord your God will put out those nations before you little and little. You may not consume them at once, lest the beast of the field increase upon you, but the Lord your God shall deliver them unto you, and shall destroy them with a mighty destruction, until they be destroyed. And he shall deliver their kings into your hand, and you shall destroy their name from under heaven. There shall no man be able to stand before you until you have destroyed them. Now, let's fast forward again to 1983. And remember in verse 17 he said, how can I dispossess them? And the British, back in 1983, found it necessary to do some military dispossessing after Argentina invaded the British Falkland Islands in the South Atlantic. And that brief war captured the attention of the whole world, and much has been written about it. there's a book that you can get out of the library, and it's called The Falklands Miracle, and it deals with all the so-called incredibly good luck that the British experienced, and so many at so many different times during that very short conflict. One example for now was that at the very time that the Argentine army surrendered at the Falkland Islands capital of Port Stanley, the British were almost completely out of ammunition. And if the Argentinians would not have surrendered at precisely that time, the Brits would have had to retreat, and that would have prolonged the conflict. There would have been more loss of life, and possibly the final result of the war could have even been reversed. Got another story about the Falklands miracle, and it wasn't from that book, but it was rather came from a cousin of mine who lived close to my relatives in Liverpool, and this cousin was serving in the British Army at the time, and he had to have some special training, you know, and with thousands of his comrades, they put him aboard the luxury P&O liner, the Canberra, which some of you might be familiar with, the P&O Orient line, the Canberra, which had been hurriedly converted and pressed into service as a troop ship. Imagine thousands of British soldiers on there. And as they steamed into the South Atlantic, the ship was actually virtually unarmed at the time. You know, it didn't have big guns on it or anti-aircraft guns. And they came under severe attack from Argentinian jet fighters. And these planes, and this is, you know, what I was told there, that they attacked one side of the Canberra with their rockets and fired the rockets in there. And they peeled off and came back again, time and time again. And they concentrated their aim on the same side of the ship. And all the rockets did explode. But for some reason, my cousin said, the explosions did not penetrate the hull of the Canberra. And the soldiers watching from the decks there, and obviously quite fearfully I would have been, reported the explosions seemed to merely bounce off the hull and inflicted very little damage, and they got to the Falklands to do what they had to do. On investigation, it was discovered that back in the 1960s, when the Canberra was first built in Belfast, at Harland and Walsh Yard in Belfast, the engineers found that there was an unacceptable twist in the hull of the ship. And it threw off the whole balance and design of the ship, and it had to be straightened out. To correct the twist, more weight was required on one side of the hull. And that weight was provided by lining that side of the hull with a couple of inches of reinforced concrete. So, you know, you just turn that over in your mind and see that, 20 years before that God knew what was going to happen. So we can relate stories, and I'm sure we all have such stories, and we know these stories or accounts, let's not call them stories, they're accounts of God's miraculous deliverance. It appears that the physical descendants of Israel have been over and over been miraculously protected and delivered in order to fulfill God's promises to Abraham. However, God's word does tell us that one day, and probably soon, we don't know, due to the unrepentant disobedience and idolatry of our Israelitish nations, that those blessings of protection and deliverance will be taken away. Don't look forward to that. But what about spiritual Israel? What about God's true church? What about you and me? Does God protect us do his promises of physical deliverance also apply to us? And we can have the confidence that yes, they do. I want to relate an instance there, an example that came to mind when I was writing this. And this takes me back to a winter's night in Ontario some years ago, when one of our Canadian ministers used to be in BC, and then he's, but at that time he was back in Ontario, a snowy winter's night, when he fell asleep at the wheel of his car when he was driving home after a particularly exhausting day, going down one of those long, straight, lonely roads that you see in Ontario, and his wife as well was also dozing in the car. And all of a sudden, they both heard a loud, clear voice shout, "John!" And it woke them both instantly and averted a possibly dreadful crash. Now, I can't remember whether, I'd have to ask him again about it, about the details, but I can't remember now whether he got out of the car right away or if he went back to the scene the following day. But anyway, he told me that he retraced the car's tire tracks in the snow for a short distance, and he found that the tire tracks disappeared as they approached the side of the road and the ditch, and then reappeared again a few yards further on. And the car should have crashed into a deep roadside ditch. And it, you know, and that was first hand I heard that from this minister. So again, you know, you probably heard similar stories, I'm sure you have, and they're all always inspiring to read about or to listen to. But why should we be surprised at such things? They're wonderful accounts. God has given us a solid but conditional promise of protection, and we've seen that in the scriptures that we've read already. Let's go to Joshua chapter 1, please. Joshua chapter 1. Joshua chapter 1. Because I said conditional. And I believe that the word, these words that the Lord spoke to Joshua before he led the Israelites into the promised land, that they also apply to you and me. Joshua chapter 1 and verse 5. Joshua chapter 1 and verse 5. No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. Apply that to yourself, brethren, every single one of us. Apply it to ourselves. I will not fail you or forsake you. Verse 6, be strong and of good courage, for you shall cause this people to inherit the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Now here come the conditions, verse 7. Only be strong and very courageous, being careful to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. Turn not from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may have good success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart out of your mouth, for you shall meditate on it day and night. It's like Robinson Crusoe did. Meditate on it day and night, that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you shall make your way prosperous, and then you shall have good success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and of good courage. Be not frightened, neither be dismayed. For the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. Jump down to verse 18. There's a warning there too. Whoever rebels against your commandment and disobeys your words, whatever you command him shall be put to death. Only be strong and of good courage. So, again, we ask the question, were those promises only for the people of Old Covenant physical Israel, or And the answer is no. And some of these words are repeated to the new covenant, Israel of God. Let's go over to Hebrews again, please. Hebrews chapter 13. And where we see these same words repeated. Hebrews chapter 13 and verses 5 and 6. And we read this one already. Let your conversation or your conduct be without covetousness, and be content with such things as you have. For he, the Lord, has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So that we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper, and I will not fear what man shall do unto me. So if we strive, brethren, to keep his word and obey him in these and all other ways as well, he promises his protection. Yes, and you know, if we happen to be still alive when the end times come, he'll protect us even from the future worldwide hour of severe trial. Let's just read that as our last scripture there. Revelation chapter 3. Revelation chapter 3 and verse 10. Revelation chapter 3 and verse 10. Because you have kept the word of my patience, there's the condition there, I also will keep you from the hour of temptation or trial, which shall come upon the world to try them that dwell upon the earth. So we can have the fullest confidence that God will give us his divine protection when we need it. And like Joshua, and like the members of the early Church of God, we too should be strong and of good courage. And if we remain content with the many blessings that God has given us, which I'm sure we are, I mean, look where we live, you know, if we continue to worship him and obey him and serve him as he commands us, and to the best of our understanding, he will never leave us nor forsake us. So now we come to the end of this long series. How do we wrap it up? Let me just summarize what we've been through. I'm not going to go through all the detail. Let me just summarize what we've been through in the last five sermons then. In our own local area, we're going through a very troubled time. Not just our local area, but many other congregations and church groups as well. And brethren, as you know, every week we've got these prayer requests. And we're going through a particular troubled time in God's church. And again, right here on Vancouver Island. But we have to remember, most of the brethren are not yet being persecuted in the classic sense of the term. Yeah, we're going through trials, but most of us are not being severely persecuted in the classic sense of the term. Many of us are, though, going through some very severe trials right now. But they're not necessarily trials that have not been commonly suffered by God's people in past eras. And they're not necessarily trials that are not commonly being suffered by other Church of God brethren around the world right now, and non-Church of God people too. But still, they're trials that we need some help with. Help from one another, and help, of course, from God the Father and Jesus. What kind of help do we ask for from God the Father and Jesus? In many cases, we're asking for relief and for healing according to their perfect will. The perfect will of God the Father and Jesus. And if our complete healing is not their will at this time, then we need some major encouragement and comfort to help us to get through these tough times. But how? By what means can we expect this encouragement and comfort to come to us? Yes, we talked about seeking encouragement and comfort from our physical family members and our friends, but also, more so, from our beloved spiritual brothers and sisters in God's true church, but primarily from our Almighty Father and from our elder brother, our elder brother who's been through, who voluntarily went through so much of what we're going through now, but much, much more, much worse than what we're going through now. But is that all? You know, we go through the scriptures and we ask the question, can we be fully and effectively encouraged and comforted just by and through the mere academic knowledge of the great power of God the Father and Jesus Christ? Or can we be comforted and encouraged by their desire to encourage and comfort us? Or can we be encouraged by our knowledge of Jesus' past sufferings? Well, the answer is no. In addition to these things, we can and we should have their encouragement and their comfort in us, right inside of us. How? Once again, by allowing Jesus and God the Father even to live in us and to work in us. And again, how? By the coming of the Comforter, by being imbued with the Holy Spirit of truth.